You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 1st, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Happy October, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, everyone.
Guess what today is?
Today is my daughter's 6th birthday.
Happy birthday, Autumn.
Happy birthday.
Girl gets cuter every day. I swear she does.
And 44 years prior to her birth was the birth of NASA.
That's right, 50 years old.
Happy birthday, wow. NASA. It gets cuter every day.
NASA used to be NACA. it sure does. National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics.
NACA?
It was NACA since 1915. Up until October 1st, 1958, in which they made it the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So, yay, NASA, 50.
Yay.
Jay is not with us again this week. He's fine. There's no need to be concerned about Jay, but he is simply unavailable.
He's paragliding in Ecuador.
He's rescuing turtle eggs on the shores of Key West.
He's whittling small pieces of bark for blind orphans in the Andes. It's actually really touching.
I thought he was running a triathlon in Sri Lanka.
Well, he was still finishing that novel.
Is there any training for that Mars mission that's coming up?
No, you're thinking about that sleep study where he has to sit in a box for 30 days and pee in a jar.
I think he's just downloading porn.
It's a really long download. Doesn't want to interrupt.
Jay, Jay can quite literally do that one-handed. I don't think he needs to take off.
Remember, Jay downloads porn while he's doing the podcast, so he can multitask.
Oh, boy.
Well, we have a few news items this week. The first is updates on Mars. The Phoenix mission is just
still
turning
there.
Up new and exciting things every week.
It's snowing.
That's right, Rebecca. It's snowing. They've detected snow falling on the Martian clouds. I guess that's the first time.
We haven't even gotten any snow in Boston. Now it's snowing on Mars already? Jeez.
Well, the Martian winter strikes earlier than in Boston. But so apparently about 2.5 miles above the surface, they're detecting snow. It hasn't reached the surface. They don't know if the snow falls to the surface, but they're going to be paying closer attention to that to see if, in fact, it does. So.
That's really cool, because in my head I picture Mars as this, you know, dusty, dead planet, but I don't know, it's really neat to imagine it. Imagine a white Christmas on Mars.
No, and in fact, the other thing that they mentioned this week is that their experiments have yielded that there's calcium carbonate on the surface.
What's that mean?
And particles that could be clay. Well, these are all indicators that Mars had a very wet surface to it. A very, very, very long time ago. So the data is, you know, just from this mission alone, I'm sure they've made some big positive steps here, and they are accumulating this data, and it is certainly all pointing in the direction that Mars, a very long time ago, was a very wet wonderland.
Calcium carbonate is also known as limestone, so there's limestone on Mars. It also found perchlorate, which is a chemical compound used by plants and microbes. So, you know, there's some suggestion that not only was this a wet area in the past, but it may have been a wet life-bearing area in the past. This is all inferential information. It's not direct evidence, but it is pretty intriguing. I will say that we are planning on bringing back Diana Blaney from the JPL, who promised, we interviewed her at the beginning of the Phoenix mission, and she said that she would come back when the Phoenix mission has completed. They are extending the mission as long as the Martian sun is, you know, charging up the batteries through the solar panels, as long as they're getting enough energy until the real deep Martian winter sets in. They'll get every bit of work out of the lander that they can. And when everything is done, Diana's going to come back on the show and talk to us and wrap up all of the findings of over the summer of the Phoenix mission.
Cool.
You know, one of the last things they are going to attempt to do is to turn on a microphone that's on the lander.
Oh, so we can hear Mars.
Listen to Mars for the first time. And
hear cool. What, Mars what a good idea. Like.
That's a great idea.
I can't wait until they turn on the nose.
And smell Mars.
What was it? Was it a smelloscope?
Oh, from Futurama? Yeah, that's right. The smelloscope. As long as you don't make me smell Uranus, right? That was the joke.
Right, right.
They turn on the recorder and you hear somebody say, "Wait, stay behind the camera."
Yeah. Don't throw a shadow that way.
Yeah, the big feet, man. You got to get big feet, or hiding behind the camera.
First there was the moon hoax. Now there's the Mars hoax. You know, that's inevitable.
That's funny. You don't really hear anybody saying that they didn't really send a robot to Mars.
Ooh, perhaps I've just started something. I've planted the acorn.
Yeah, don't give me any ideas.
That will grow into the mighty oak of pseudoscience. That is the Mars hoax.
Now, last week, there was a news item that we didn't get to involving PETA. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
People eating tasty animals.
Or eating tasty animals.
I've heard that.
Depending upon your preference.
You know, PETA, speaking as the resident animal lover, not literally, I'm not into bestiality, so before those rumors get started, I just like animals.
Too late. They're just friends.
I hate PETA, really. Like, you know, the animal rights movement or what have you could be really strong and good, and there's a lot of crap to clean up in the industry, you know, well, you know, in the meat production industry and things like that. But PETA is just so friggin' off the wall, and so they did it again. They are seriously petitioning Ben and Jerry's to replace cow's milk in their ice cream with people milk, which is gross. They say that it'll be better for the cows and better for the consumer. And, I mean, one of those is true. Presumably it'd be better for the cows because cows who are milked generally don't have the best lives. And, you know, there's some problems with the dairy industry with getting cows pregnant. And then what do you do with the babies? And it's a whole big mess that should probably, you know, get a critical eye turned on it. But not by getting a bunch of women to donate their breast milk and put it into my ice cream.
Ben and Jerry's ice cream.
Maybe it will be tougher on the cows. If they're not milking the cows, maybe they just turn them into hamburgers. So it might be even worse on the cows.
Well, possibly. I don't know, though. It's, you know, which would be worse? Would it be worse to just be killed, or is it worse to live a life like what they live, you know?
I'd rather be milked than have my carotid artery cut.
Don't cows and dairy farms have to be inspected by health people and so forth? I imagine if you're going to have a woman milking farm of some kind, that would also have to be, hopefully, under some very strict supervision.
In PETA's fantasy world, I think, you know, you'd have plenty of women standing by to just donate all of the gallons of breast milk they happen to be pumping out and throwing away for some reason. And, you know, there's just simply, first of all, nowhere near enough breast milk to ever meet the demand of the consumer, assuming that there is a demand for ice cream made of breast milk. And really, why not? You know, if we can drink cow milk, then it's not very skeptical, I guess, to automatically say, well, drinking people milk is gross.
Drinking milk is people.
It's perception, though. It's just pure perception. And when I first saw this, I would have bet literally $500, $1,000 that this was a joke. It's just so over-the-top ridiculous that I was
obviously
convinced.
You haven't been paying attention to PETA because they do is.
But this has to take the cake just on so many levels. It's just so ridiculous.
With a glass
and,
of milk.
And Rebecca, you're right. I mean, there should be nothing inherently wrong with you know, milk from breast milk from women, but just the logistics of it are just so crazy. I mean, the quality control and getting, how many women would you actually need? A million? 500,000?
You'd need a lot. And you make a good point about quality control that should be highlighted, because a lot of activists are anti-milk and say one of the reasons we shouldn't drink milk is because hormones are getting into the milk, or you know, all the drugs they're pumping into cows end up in the milk, and then you ingest it, and it's bad for you. Well,
right.
Imagine all of the drugs that, you know, these millions of women that would be required for this would be on. It'd be impossible to keep them all living 100% drug-free while they're milking themselves.
Every day.
The logistics.
The whole thing is utterly ridiculous.
Really, the only reason why we did this news story really was for the puns.
Yes.
So
I think set me up for that pun. But the PETA, the problem with PETA is they're actually horrible advocates for their own position because they embrace any argument, no matter how ridiculous or pseudoscientific it is, as long as the end result is not using animals for anything, right?
Right.
Well, I don't even think that that's their end result. I mean, it's, you know, ideally it is, but really what PETA goes for, you know, 9 times out of 10 is pure shock.
We weren't even going to talk about this issue last, you know, at all, and we skipped it last week, but this week PETA topped themselves even more ridiculous. So now that they're putting out an ad campaign called Got Autism. Again, they have their sights set on milk. Oh. And the ad says, studies have shown a link between cow's milk and autism.
Oh, what? Yeah.
Utter crap. Just nonsense. So I love the studies have shown, right? They could say studies plural because there were two. They're old studies, they're small, they're crappy, and the results have been later overturned by bigger, larger, better studies. There is no link between milk, you know, cow's milk and autism.
Wow.
And in any case, even the initial studies were showing that maybe it exacerbated the symptoms of autism, not that it caused it. It's deceptive on multiple levels. But even that didn't pan out. There's just nothing to it at all. So they'll cherry pick old, crappy, debunked studies as long as they could, as you say, Rebecca, could put up the shocking billboard to try to scare people away.
And let's face it, autism is hot right now, and they're very good at picking out whatever happens to be in the headlines and hopping on that train. And the thing is, all of the vegetarians and vegans and animal rights activists I know absolutely cannot stand PETA, we'll say at every opportunity that PETA does not represent their views, and it's a shame that PETA continues to exist and do what they do. But wait, did you guys want to offer any breast milk puns for the Ben and Jerry's ice cream before we
move off of it?
No, shut up.
Before we move on, I have a few from the Straight Dope message boards. My favorites were, I can't believe it's not mother. a pail of two titties.
Oh.
Yeah. Nipple ripple.
Nipple ripple.
Titstachio.
These are the flavors that are going to come.
Yeah.
So, you know, I know that the listeners enjoy, participating in these things. So if you have a good Ben and Jerry's breast milk name, send it on in.
Yeah, maybe we'll say that we'll choose a winner and say it next week. One more news item. I blogged about this last week. A new study showing that there may be differences in the effects of calorie restriction on life extension for mice and for humans. This is kind of a narrow science topic to talk about, but we have talked about this topic on this podcast multiple times before, so that's why I thought it was worth bringing up for follow-up. I know, Bob, you've followed this research quite a bit, the effects of calorie restriction on longevity.
Yeah, calorie restriction, I've been following that for years, and it seemed to be one of the very few proven methods for significantly extending lifespan, shown over and over in animals ranging from yeast to nematodes to monkeys. The basic idea is that you eat 30% fewer calories than you normally would, but still, of course, consuming adequate vitamins and minerals and other nutrients. When this is done to these animals, they just blow past all previous records for longevity, some of them living more than 50% or more longer than they normally would have. And this translated so well to many different animals. People, of course, will think that, it will probably work for humans too. And there's actually many people throughout the country and maybe even the world that actually put themselves on this difficult, restricted diet. It's difficult to do.
Yeah, it's hard to eat that little and still get decent nutrition. Yeah.
Right.
And also not look like a ghoulish freak.
Yeah, I've seen some people that do this, and boy, they are skinny.
Do they take vitamins and stuff?
I'm sure they do.
Yeah, you pretty much have to.
Now, so this latest news, I'm sure, was very disappointing to these CR, or calorie restriction proponents. But it's not all bad, however. If you dig a little deeper past the headlines in the first few paragraphs, for me, the main star of this show was the IGF-1, or insulin-like growth factor. It's a protein produced by the liver that stimulates cell growth and has also been linked to cancer in high levels. One thing that longevity studies agree on, that low levels of this protein are somehow crucially important for the increased lifespan of these lab animals. So they're looking at this protein very, very closely. In this latest study, they were very surprised, therefore, when they looked at these IGF-1 levels in the humans and the people that were in the study. They were no different than people who eat normally. It was a big surprise that these levels didn't go down.
And therefore, I mean, if lower levels of IGF-1 is the mechanism of longevity brought about by calorie restriction, and humans don't have the same effect that mice have, then that would mean that humans don't have the longevity effect either.
Right.
Right. However, there is the wrinkle that you alluded to, and that is if you have a very low protein diet, then that does lower IGF-1 levels.
Right. They looked at vegans that they were also following, and they typically ate, say, 10% of their calories came from protein, whereas calorie restriction people were 23%, and their IGF-1 levels were significantly lower. The bottom line, I think, for these people that are trying to affect their longevity is that I think what it seems like a no-brainer, what they would obviously do is lower their protein down a little lower than what it was, and hopefully, they'll be getting some of this these longevity boosts.
There's still a lot of ifs in there, though, Bob, because we don't know that you get the same benefit at a low protein.
Absolutely.
We don't know, even though there's some suggestion of it, we don't know that IGF-1 is the magic mechanism of this.
All right.
It's
I agree.
Really hard to lower your protein and still have a diet that you can live with. I mean, there may be downsides to it that will offset any putative upside to having
absolutely.
Lower IGF-1 levels.
I'm not. Yep, I agree. I'm not recommending this diet. Yeah. I could never pull this off. These are just the kind of people that are on, they try to be on the cutting edge and they try to extrapolate from current research, and maybe they're right, maybe they're not right, but this is what they're doing. And hey, if someone's going to do it and go and put themselves through that, then if we could actually learn from it and benefit and learn a little about it, then that's great. But I think it's important to point out that these people aren't just wasting their time and wasting away, so to speak. They've actually documented, as far as I can tell, clear cardiovascular benefits for this calorie restricted lifestyle. So it's not just like, oh, let's hope I live 30 years longer. There are some clear benefits to this that they have documented. It's just unfortunate that one of them wasn't increased longevity, it appears, and maybe the protein is a factor, maybe not, but there are benefits.
Right, but the bottom line is there's no substitute for studies in people looking at net effects. Animals, it's always a question mark. How good is an animal model of any situation, any specific disease, or in this case, longevity? I think, generally speaking, that perhaps mice are not a good model for humans overall in terms of longevity, probably because mechanisms of mice aging over 2 to 3 years are probably not close enough to the mechanisms of human aging over 80 years. And the IGF-1 is just one specific difference now that has come up in this research. Definitely this kind of research, because it's very reductionist and it's trying to look at what's really happening, will teach us a lot about the aging process and about the different animal models and how they relate to human metabolism and biology. But I don't think we're anywhere near a final recommendation about what is the net health effect of these really severely restrictive diets. And the early adopters, it's just a crapshoot. The ones who are doing it now, they're really, it's just as likely to harm them as it is to help them, I think, given the level of evidence that we have so far. Well, let's go on to a few of your emails. First, a couple of corrections and extensions from last week. We had a few emails about the Large Hadron Collider. Here's a representative one from Amanda Mason from Lansing, Michigan. She writes, "Hi, guys. Bob seemed very upset that the LHC won't be back up until spring because they need to do the winter maintenance. I thought it might make him feel better to know that, according to the Scientific American podcast, the LHC has their yearly maintenance during the winter because the LHC draws so much power. Apparently, the power grid it runs off can either heat-run Geneva or cool-run the LHC. So if we really want the LHC up for the winter, We just have to convince Geneva to invest heavily in extra sweaters. Your adoring fan, Amanda.
Now, like you said, Steve, we got a lot of emails from people about this Large Hadron Collider issue shutting down in the winter. But I'd just like to point out that, Amanda, you were the only one who actually suggested a solution, which is convincing Geneva to invest in sweaters. So thank you for that. That's constructive.
It's great advice, yes.
Yeah, that actually did make me feel a little bit better. I did track down that Scientific American podcast, and according to George Musser, that is indeed the case. The choice is run the collider or heat Geneva. That's a no-brainer, so I do feel better that there's really no way around that.
Yeah. Now, I tried to verify that, too. I went to the LHC blog and several other sources, and this is a subtle point, but what they were saying was not that the electricity isn't there, just that it would be a lot more expensive. So since such colliders need to shut down for maintenance as part of their routine, they always choose to shut down when the electricity is going to be the most expensive because it's in the highest demand. So I don't know. Maybe the capacity isn't there, or it may just be that it would be very, very expensive. I don't know. But I
got that sense as well.
It's a subtle point, but you know, either way, that's the reason, because of the availability / expense of electricity during the winter months.
And certainly, they've accounted for it. I mean, they must have known this many, many years ago that this would have to be a seasonal project in that respect.
Yes, it's not the only thing. Other large facilities also choose their maintenance period during the time of peak energy demand and cost. If you're in a warm climate, that would be in the summer, and in a cold climate in the winter. I also picked up a couple of little details while I was confirming that point, that the reason it's so slow to heat up the section that requires the maintenance. So, they melted a transformer there and they have to repair it. And it takes several weeks to heat up that section to room temperature down from the 4 to 5 Kelvin that it operates at. And it's because they use helium to cool it, and helium is very expensive. So they need to warm it up very slowly so that they can heat up the helium slowly and they can siphon it off and store it so that they can use it again later. Apparently, if they heat up
for
too
parties
quickly,
when they want
to
talk like
they
munchkins.
Have to vent the helium and then they have to and waste it. So just because it's really expensive, they do it slowly.
And so you'd have a lot of birds flying over the LHC with really high pitched voices.
That's right. The other quick correction has to do with the science or fiction segment about gamers, video gamers, being more healthy than the typical stereotype. This comes from Eric Panzer, who writes, "Dear Skeptical Rogues, I must first say that I am a devoted listener and fan of the show. I have shared it with several friends, one of whom can barely go a single conversation without mention of something skepticentric. I'm writing because I thought y'all's discussion of the gamer profile study missed an important point. While gamers may very well be healthier or otherwise better off than the general population, it is also important to consider how they compare to their demographic peers, especially those who are non-gamers. The study showed that gamers tended to have higher educational and socioeconomic attainment than the general population. There is strong evidence that these same factors are correlated with better health. Given this, the question we must really ask is, how does the health of gamers compare to that of their non-gaming counterparts with similar demographic parameters, income, education, race, etc.? I'm sure you guys consider this sort of potential common cause issue, but thought it bore an explicit mention on the show." Yeah, that's absolutely correct, Eric. We didn't mention it because it didn't pertain to what we were discussing, was the fact that gamers are different than the stereotyped image of a gamer, which is somebody who's fat, non-athletic, and out of shape. In fact, taken as a whole, they are more fit than the general population. The study didn't say, we didn't say, and we didn't mean to imply that gaming makes them more healthy,
right?
Or that gaming is an independent predictor of being more healthy than the general population, which is what you're talking about. It's not necessarily an independent predictor because it may be riding along with other factors that are also correlate and are more plausibly causative. So also you can't really draw any cause and effect conclusion from these correlational types of studies where you're just gathering data about multiple variables and seeing what correlates with what. So all your points are valid. They just were just tangential to what we were talking about. But it's worth pointing out because it's just, we want people to understand how to think about this kind of data. So thanks for writing in. The next email comes from Ivy Gordon in Ohio, and she writes, "Hello, my name Ivy. I love you long time." Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's the wrong one. Hello, my name is Ivy, and I've just recently become a listener of the show. There we go. I really enjoy it, and even though none of my friends are skeptics, I still tell them about the show. At any rate, my question has to do with religious debate, and this argument seems to come up most often from Christians. This is the argument I get from them other than Pascal's wager. Humans are obviously more than animals. We have self-awareness, and just looking at how much human beings have accomplished and our range of emotions that animals just don't share point to a spark of something greater than the sum of our neurons. Humans must have a soul because science can't explain how this emergent property occurs in our brains. I simply have no answer to this argument other than to say that lack of an adequate explanation from science is not proof of their argument. I just would like to know if there is research going on about this and what's happening within that field. Alternatively, what would your response be to this sort of argument?" Well, Ivy, this is a very good question. We also do get this a lot. I've actually been debating this point with creationists and others on my blog, Neurologica, for a year now or more.
Argument from ignorance.
Yeah, I mean, so I think you've identified the core, you know, fallacy here is saying that, you know, neuroscientists don't understand how the brain exactly, you know, produces all of the mental phenomena that we observe. Doesn't mean that there's a non-physical or materialist cause for the mind, or that specifically it's spiritual in nature, or that, you know, humans have a soul. So that's the argument from.
Although, you know, before you even get to logical fallacy, I think you have a basic problem with getting the facts wrong. Not you, Ivy, but your friend has a problem with getting the facts wrong, because when, like, the first point is humans are obviously more than animals, which is you can throw right out because it's not at all obvious. We are very different from a lot of other animals, but that doesn't make us more than. Saying that we have self-awareness and implying that other animals do not is also wrong, because there's a lot of research going on with many different animals. It's difficult to determine, but it seems at this point that there are a lot of animals that have a wide array of levels of self-awareness, which kind of fits into the idea that we're just one step further, maybe, on the evolutionary ladder when it comes to self-awareness. Mm-hmm. But there's been plenty of studies with elephants and with, I know, some birds.
Chimpanzees, yeah.
Gibbons.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Rebecca. So this is a bit of a false premise as well, and also drawing, again, a false dichotomy between humans and animals, when really it's a spectrum, you know, and those animals that are most intellectually sophisticated show a lot of features, actually, that humans have in terms of emotions and planning, et cetera.
It's kind of, and to draw a metaphor to it, it's kind of like saying humans are obviously more than just animals because we have the ability to make and use tools. Mm-hmm. But then you could point to other animals like chimpanzees that have a primitive ability to, you know, use sticks to fish out bugs from logs and things like that. You can kind of see where we might have developed these tools.
Right. Although, you know, having said that, that's all true, but that doesn't mean that humans don't have mental capacities that are beyond even the most intelligent animals. Clearly we do. I mean, we've developed a technological civilization and culture that is hugely beyond what any animals have, even though they have rudimentary elements of it. Some neuroscientists think that one of the key things that humans evolved that even our closest relatives don't have is a real solid grasp of the notion of cause and effect, that we understand that, you know, what we do and actions that we take directly have effects, and that enables us to plan out our actions knowing that they will have specific consequences. Then we can think about those consequences and then, you know, act accordingly in order to achieve some result. So it allows us to do sophisticated planning that other animals who do, like, really rudimentary planning can't do, because they have more learned behavior where they know they've learned the fact that when they do A, B happens. So they do A to achieve B. But we could conceptually, abstractly think about how A might cause B and then do it. So anyway, so there are certainly things like that where we have more sophisticated neurological capability, but the rudiments of everything that we could do can be observed and seen in the animal kingdom. You know, we definitely evolved out of animals. We are not something completely separate. You know, it's not like our brain has a unique design that has no roots or elements in the animal kingdom at all. It really is a spectrum of different levels of awareness, levels of emotion, etc. So just, you know, to sum up, I guess, Ivy, so point out that that's a false premise, and also that it's the argument is the logical fallacy of the argument from ignorance. And in fact, and also I point out often in my blog that not knowing exactly how something works doesn't mean that we can't confidently say that it does work, right? So because we can't say exactly how the brain produces all mental phenomenon doesn't mean that we don't know that the brain produces mental phenomenon, that there has to be something, some ghost in the machine, some magical element to it. One more email. This one comes from Cal Gardner from the USA, and Cal writes, I'm delighted with your show. I'm a natural skeptic, and I've listened to all of your episodes. Hey, wait a minute. He spells skeptic with a C, and yet he says he's from the USA.
Two Cs, actually.
Mm. He's an anomaly.
Anomaly. The other day, I heard you say something that made me say, what? You said casually that there was some evidence that Neanderthals and Homo sapiens shared DNA, as if there was a smoking alley-oop gun out there. Huh? Are you saying that there is mitochondrial DNA evidence that those presumed distinct species crossed? We've all seen big, hairy, 300-pound knuckle-dragging linebackers with 90-pound nubile blonde cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. That's deviation toward the mean. But where is the definitive evidence? I see missing links all over the place, but that doesn't make it so. How much Neanderthal DNA can we trace? We have an Iceman from the Alps, but I don't recall an Encino Man being found outside of Hollywood. Tool making is one thing, but making it with another species still seems unnatural to me. What portion of human DNA can anyone point to that defines the Neanderthal line? Can we define the Neanderthal genome at all? Are there any intact specimens? This scenario looks circumstantial at best. Please explain. Well, that was a puntastic email, Cal. But the evidence is actually quite interesting, and I did just make some casual asides about it. But here's the scoop in a little bit more detail. The question is, what is the relationship between Homo neanderthalensis and Homo sapiens? The Neanderthal man is definitely the closest cousin of the human species. In fact, for a time, it was accepted that maybe they were a subspecies, the Homo sapiens sapiens and Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, but the current consensus is that they should be considered a separate species. Well, we've actually isolated Neanderthal DNA from several specimens over the last few years and are in the process of sequencing the Neanderthal genome.
Wow.
They only have a few percent of it done so far. So we have far from a complete sequence. And I'm not sure if the quality of the DNA we have is sufficient that we will get a complete sequence. It might be. I'm not sure.
Well, how much of their genome do you think we have?
I'm not sure of the quality of the DNA we have and if we will be able to completely sequence it from that. But that's what they're working on. Is what I've read. So they're working on completing the genome.
Wow.
Whether or not they'll be able to do it or not, we'll have to just wait and see.
They would grow one in a jar.
So with the data that we have so far, there have been multiple papers comparing the Neanderthal DNA to human genetic information in various ways. And what they've come up with so far is that the last common ancestor between humans and Neanderthal man was about 600,000 or so years ago. I've read between 400 and 660,000. I think the date has been moving back a little bit with newer evidence. So around 600,000 years ago. If Neanderthal man and humans interbred after that point, it's been very minimal. So it's either no interbreeding after that point or minimal interbreeding after that point. There is no smoking gun evidence that we've definitely interbred with Neanderthals, but neither has it been ruled out. However, there are some researchers who think that there is evidence. And what we're looking for are specific alleles, which is a type of a gene that looks like it came that we share with Neanderthal man. One analysis that was done to look at Neanderthal DNA and the different races around the world, thinking that if there was any interbreeding going on, that the European populations would have that Neanderthal DNA, but that other populations like African and Asian would not. And therefore, Europeans would be closer to Neanderthal DNA than other races. And they, what they found was no difference. So that line of reasoning did not show any evidence of interbreeding between Neanderthals and Europeans. Other researchers focused on seeing, again, are there these specific alleles? There are a couple of candidates that there are people saying maybe these alleles came from Neanderthal DNA and then persisted in the human population because they had some advantage. They were, there were selective pressures to retain these crossed over alleles into the human line, specifically microcephalin and the tau proteins. But that's, that has not yet been proven. Those are just proposed at this point in time. That's basically where the research is. We're going to expect to see more and more papers come out as we more fully sequence the Neanderthal genome. Right now, we haven't ruled out any interbreeding. There's some suggestion that it might have gone on. But if it did, it was definitely very, very minimal. It seems like our lines have been mostly or completely separate for about 600,000 years. Well, let's go on to the interview. We are sitting down now with Matthew Chapman. Matthew, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you.
And Matthew is a journalist and author. You confront frequently the creation-evolution debate. And incidentally, you happen to be the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin. I got that right?
Yes.
So tell us what he was like.
Well, I remember sitting on his knee in like 1852 thinking, wow, it's hard to believe that this guy... Yeah.
I do wonder, you know, was your lineage, did that spur you to do what you do today?
No, quite the opposite, actually. I mean, the central joke of my life is that Charles Darwin was my great-great-grandfather, who was, you know, like he's a... perhaps wrote the most important book in the last 2,000 years in terms of how we look at the world. My great-grandfather was Sir Francis Darwin, who was a pretty good botanist in his own right and catalogued his father's work. My grandmother was called Frances Darwin, and she was a pretty good poet but had some sort of mental problems here and there. My mother was an alcoholic housewife, and I am in the movie business. So what you see is you see actually the descent of man is reinterpreted in a sort of devolutionary sense. And as I grew up, there was a great deal of pressure to be academically successful, not just on my mother's side, which is the Darwin side, but my grandfather on my father's side was a physicist who had put together the International Geophysical Year, which was a year when geophysicists from all over the world, including Russia during the Cold War, cooperated on various geophysical projects. And, you know, he was involved in understanding the mechanism of the ozone layer. So there was, and he was a professor at Trinity and blah, blah, blah. All the family went to college and university and so on. I left school at 14 and a half and started working. And I think it was because I just sort of, I thought, well, I can't compete with all this stuff. I'll go the other way. It was 1965. There was plenty of fun things to do. Only when I came to America in the 80s did I get interested in the whole thing of Darwin, because then it became, rather than being part of the establishment, which is what it was like being a Darwin descendant in England, to be a Darwin here was, there was some real rough and tumble involved in it, you know, and it was, there was a good fight to be had. Mm-hmm. Because to my astonishment, I found in the 80s that there were all these battles going on of people trying to get creationism taught as a scientific theory, which I just thought was completely bizarre and anachronistic and still do.
And so do we.
Yeah, oh, yeah. We do as well.
Unfortunately, not many of our countrymen do.
Yeah.
It's peculiar. I mean, still it's a majority of people. Mm-hmm. Doubt evolution.
Right. And in fact, you may find this interesting that, and I'm sure you know, that the creationist and intelligent design proponents use the word Darwinist as a pejorative against people who accept the scientific consensus on evolution.
Well, and this was actually, this was one of the stranger things about the two books that I've written, because the first book I wrote was called Trials of the Monkey, an Accidental Memoir, and it was about a journey I took down to Tennessee to go to the town where the Scopes monkey trial took place. Yeah. So I went down there, and the idea of it was a Darwin descending below the Bible Belt to see if the town itself had evolved in any way philosophically since 1925, which it had not. But I got very fond of it. I liked the town. I liked the people. So I really got to know a lot of people down there, and I went, for example, on a creationist spelunking trip, which was terrifying, going into this cave with these creationists who were trying to show that brachiopods had been rushed in there by the flood and then rushed out again, and that's why they were there as opposed to geological. But so I met a lot of people down there, and they were very nice and very polite, and I talked about Darwin, and they talked about their thing. And when I came to Pennsylvania 5 years later to cover the Kitzmiller v. Dover trial for Harper's, I did the same thing. I got to know a lot of people. And the hatred for Darwin had grown exponentially. I mean, it had really changed, and you could feel it talking, because I talked to preachers down there. I talked to preachers in Pennsylvania. There is a definitely more dislike and hatred for Darwin, and more of a sense that he was responsible for, you know, everything that is wrong with modern society.
Mm-hmm. And that's been the propaganda. And what you're telling me is that it's been working, at least within the target audience, that, you know, turning against Darwin actually has affected, you know, people's opinions negatively about Darwin the man, as opposed to just evolution, the theory.
Yeah, and he makes such a poor villain. Yeah. I mean, you know, he didn't even have an extramarital affair. He stayed with the same dreary woman for God knows how many years.
Don't speak about your great-great-grandfather. Yeah.
I mean, it's not like he's having duels, or I mean, he took one fantastic trip, and he handled that pretty well.
It's not like Newton, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody, it's not like Isaac Newton, somebody you can really get behind and say, wow, he was a bastard.
Yeah, or Caravaggio, or, you know, I mean, there are all these sort of great figures in history who have a lot of fun, and he wasn't one of them. But so he doesn't make a very good villain, but man, they hate him.
That's just astounding.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, though. I mean, you know, it's not that they could even suppose that they know anything about him personally. It's just he created, or he discovered, right? I mean, the thing that can really throw all of religion on its side. So there's quite a lot of power in that discovery.
Yeah, no, it really was. I mean, the origin of species really was a fundamentally disastrous thing for Christianity, because, I mean, page one is made to look ridiculous of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And if you interpret it literally, which I can't honestly see how you can interpret it any other way, although people seem to find ways to do that. But it's a peculiar thing to experience that hatred for someone whose work seems so harmless, and once it's been done, so obvious.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what you see when you start studying it, any kind of, however superficially,
right?
It's just so obvious why, you know, something that gets wiped out doesn't propagate, something that has little advantage does propagate, and it just seems so obvious.
That was
whose quote was that?
T.H. Huxley's response was, "How foolish of me not to have thought of that myself."
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then of course he went on to become Darwin's bulldog.
Yeah.
You still friends with the Huxleys, by the way?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I was at a party recently. This is a bit show busy, but I was at a party at Kathleen Turner's house. And I was standing next to someone, and he turned out to be a descendant of Huxley.
No.
Oh, my God.
This was in New York. So I was just kind of going, wow, that's amazing. Yeah, that Darwin is in a Huxley. Wow, that's incredible. And this actress walked in. It wasn't Heather Graham. It was like...
it wasn't, but they're excited just by that.
No, wait a second.
Thanks for saying her name anyway.
She's like a sort of radical vegetarian. She's very pretty, but kind of not.
How old? Down. How old?
30.
Pamela Anderson?
No, better actress than that. It doesn't matter. I shouldn't say anyway. So anyway, I was standing there.
Those are your hints, audience.
And she walked in. I didn't really sort of quite get who she was, but I said she was interested. I said, this is amazing. I'm Darwin's great great grandson, and this guy's Huxley's great grandson. She said, who are they?
You couldn't have been surprised at that a Hollywood actress had no clue.
Wow. That, you know what? That is effed up.
that is like, what? Maybe she misheard. You know, I mean, I was a little surprised.
Does any of the hatred towards Darwin ever trickle down to you in any way? I mean, is it like, hey, you're that guy's great-great-grandson?
You know, oddly enough, not. And I have a feeling it has something to do with the fact that I'm not your kind of snotty English guy. I did leave school very early. I did 50 menial jobs before I got into film business. I know what it's like to be a working person. I know what it's like to be broke. I know what it's like to suffer. I know what it's like to lose people who you love and so on. And I sort of, when I meet these people, I tend to kind of, I think I see a kind of pain and desperation in them usually that I feel great sympathy for. Yeah. And I think they feel that I feel that. And so, no, generally speaking, I get along with them very well. I mean, I still communicate with many, well, not many, but several preachers who I met over the years and creationists. You know.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about the talk you're going to be giving tomorrow at TAM?
Well, I'm going to be talking quite a bit about Science Debate 2008, mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is this great thing, which is I was watching the presidential debates as they began at the end, towards the end of last, you know, last year in the fall. I really could not believe that they weren't talking about science, and they weren't being asked questions about scientific issues. They weren't being asked about the health of the oceans. They weren't being asked about fresh water. They weren't being asked about pandemics or stem cell research or the genome or even economic issues like innovation and how science has fueled the economy. None of this was being asked. And in fact, I've heard recently that there have been more questions asked about UFOs mm-hmm. than they have about global warming in all of the debates.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So I just couldn't believe this. And I spoke to a friend of mine who I spoke at a conference in Washington about this. And then someone talked to me. And then I spoke to Chris Mooney, who wrote The Republican mm-hmm. War on Science. And then he and his co-blogger, Cheryl Kirschenbaum, got involved. And now there are, and then Lawrence Krauss got involved, mm-hmm. who wrote yep. yeah. Physics of Star Wars.
Yep, he spoke
Star Trek. Mm-hmm.
And then a friend of mine called Sean Lawrence Otto, who's actually a screenwriter who lives in Minnesota, got involved. And then the Union of Concerned Scientists got involved, and then the National Academies of Science. And it just kind of grew and grew and grew until now we have over 40,000 signatories.
Wow.
We have 28 Nobel laureates. We have 110 college presidents of universities and colleges in America. 110, I think it is.
How many science podcasts?
I don't know, but quite a few, I think.
You got one here. So.
I know. I was going to mention that. Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, it's just sort of grown. And
icing on a cake.
It hasn't yet had the desired effect, but we now have Nova, PBS Nova, and Now, which is their new show on Friday. And PBS itself sort of supporting the idea of this. And the AAAS, the mm-hmm. largest general science organization on Earth.
So but here we are in June 2008, and the primaries are over, even though the conventions haven't happened yet. And although from the front end things have grown huge, still no nibbles, no response from the candidates or their campaigns?
Well, we haven't put out our next invitation, which we're going to do by the end of the month. And then, you know, I mean, when we were sending out the invitations before, you had Clinton, mm-hmm. Obama, and McCain. Well, obviously, McCain, there was no advantage to him to do it. I thought there was tremendous advantage for Clinton to do it mm-hmm. because she actually has a good science thing. And, you know, her argument against Obama was that he was sort of vague and didn't have the facts. And she had a great deal of facts, and she would have been very – I think it would have been to her advantage more than anybody else's. She didn't take it, and look what happened to her.
Right. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, right, yes. Of course.
So that's not my fault. She didn't, you know, she'd taken the invitation. Wow. Obama sort of basically said no. So – now it's a different game, mm-hmm. and I think McCain has, there's a great deal of many good reasons for McCain to do it. You know, he has to attract the sort of the middle, mm-hmm. And Obama ought to do it, you know. So.
Right. So your strategy at this point is to just invite them to mm-hmm. the debate. You're not negotiating with their campaigns at all?
Well, no, we talk to their campaigns, but we invite them, and the next invitation actually, which is going to be different from before, is going to go out with 14 questions that we've developed with various organizations like mm-hmm. Scientists and Engineers for America,
yeah.
Union of Concerned Scientists, AAAS, NAS. So we've developed these 14 questions that we think are a good basis for conversation, which we haven't yet released publicly, so I can't talk about them, but I'm sure you can imagine what they are. Mm-hmm. So we're hoping that if we send those out, they can see what it is they've got mm-hmm. to address, and they'll be less intimidated because, you know, we're not asking them to understand.
Name the elements.
It's not a quiz. Yeah, no, it's just about about sort of policy decisions that you're going to make about how much money you're going to spend on basic research.
But do you think that maybe they just haven't even thought of that, and that's why they're nervous about taking an opportunity like that.
They're afraid to look stupid.
Yeah. Do you think that might be why?
Probably. Yeah. But I mean, there's no reason why you should look stupid. I mean, one of the things that I've learned in doing this is that 50% of the growth in the American economy since World War II has come from science and technology. Yeah. And so it makes economic sense to invest in improving that area of life. So it's a total no-brainer. That is very easy to talk about. When you talk about ocean health, we don't want to have that die on us. Obviously, the consequences of all of these things are you don't have to understand a great deal to understand that everything is connected. One thing I think that maybe have some effect on this is that as a European, I've found that Americans are very disinclined to look at things in an international way. That if something escapes from the borders of America, it makes them uneasy. Right. And almost all of the things the one's talking about, scientific issues, are by their very nature problems that can't be solved except by international cooperation. And that sort of internationalist attitude to life, I think, does make people uneasy, and I don't know why, because it's...
Yeah, I think I can tell you why. I mean, who the hell am I to comment on this, but...
You're an American. Go on.
In Europe, the countries are so close. They're very intermingled. And here, I mean, it's almost like we're isolationists because we don't have the opportunity, didn't have the advantage of living so close to other cultures. And, we're just pretty much by ourselves over here. In Canada, it's like, Canada and the United States, we're the same people as far as I'm concerned. Right. The Canadians don't think that.
Yeah. So it's a physical thing, but also culturally, I think there's an isolationist political movement in the United States for whatever reason.
And a president like the one we have certainly doesn't help.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
But you mentioned basically that a lot of these questions have a globalist theme, but both of the candidates now, both McCain and Obama, have been trying to strike somewhat of a globalist and internationalist theme to their campaigns. I'm not sure those campaigns would be queasy about these issues.
Perhaps not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a conjecture because I am so astonished that they didn't jump at the opportunity, because it is really, I mean, I believe that these are the most important issues that need to be discussed. I can't think of anything more important.
But they want to discuss the issues that are going to make them win, not the ones that are important. Right. So they would need to think that this is, as you say, just a political calculation that's in some sort of advantage to them. Or, and my follow-up question was going to be, are you going to try to shame them into it? Are you going to try to say they're refusing to debate these issues, and list, all the AAAS, the Nobel laureates, just as you did to us, and say, obviously the scientific world thinks that this is important, and yet the candidates are ignoring this. Is that a strategy you're going to take if they don't bite on the invitation?
I hope it doesn't come to that. And interestingly enough, I think it might not be the scientists who shame them into it. I think it might even be the evangelicals. Because one of the things that happened to us when we were trying to get the debate in Pennsylvania was that we had a couple of days that we offered them, and they chose, rather than to do our debate, they chose to do a debate on faith and values at Messiah College. It was the only debate where scientific issues were really seriously discussed. The evangelicals are genuinely concerned about the state of the earth. So I think that if the candidates believe that they can get away without talking about this, they're actually miscalculating how people are feeling in America. Because I think across the board, people want this to happen. And interestingly enough, we commissioned a Harris poll with Research America to find out things like this. And one of the questions we asked was, would you like to see the candidates have a debate on science? And exactly equally, 85% of Republicans and 85% of Democrats said yes, they would.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, that's good.
I think people really want to hear this stuff.
Yeah, that's a selling point too. And also, you said you have 14 topics that you sort of boiled this down to. I would imagine that there's something on that list that every person in every political group would care about and say, I wanted to hear them debate on that topic, number 7. That's the topic I care about. And that may lead them to pressure the candidates to do the debate.
Well, I mean, anyone who has a relative who is sick or anyone who is sick has a great desire to see people talk about stem cell research and the genome. Anyone who has children has a great desire to hear people talk about how healthy the air and the water is going to be for their children.
Anyone who breathes,
you know. So in fact, everybody has, one way or another, tremendous motivation to push for this to happen.
Did you get involved at all with the movie Expelled, Ben Stein's, you know, propaganda piece against evolution?
I didn't even see it. And it wasn't because I didn't want to. I was actually quite intrigued. Everybody said it was going to be like a huge success. And so I thought, okay, well, I can wait a couple of weeks, see that. And suddenly it disappeared.
It went into four
movie theaters, and then boom, it was in one, and then it was gone.
That was their hype machine, building it up to something it really wasn't.
Well, that's what they're supposed to do, though. I mean, that's how you...
Of course, but...
But so I mean, I saw a little sort of, and I got the gist of what it is because I've heard it from other sources. And it's this sort of conspiracy theory of the sort of, that the science community gangs up on anyone who's, you know, like... You know, if there was any good evidence to overturn evolution, everybody would be delighted.
Yeah.
It's kind of hysteria, I think.
But what about all those gaps?
There you go.
Fill a gap, make
jump
two more.
Right. But he seemed like a weird guy to be doing it because, I mean, I know he's kind of conservative, but he didn't seem to be quite that stupid.
Well,
he surprised a lot.
Yeah, when it first came out, I always heard that he was very, very intelligent. And
that's the hype
on things like economics, though, not science. I mean, he kind of has a background in science. I think he studied at Yale, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting you said earlier that you kind of came to the United States because this is where the fight was happening. Because this is really not happening over in Europe, right? I mean, is there any footprint of creationism in Europe?
Yeah, it's beginning.
It's beginning
in England, oddly enough. Yeah. And then, of course, there's that amazing Turkish book. Have you seen that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's incredible. Yeah. It's like those religious pictures, the kind of the Virgin Mary nods her head and all that.
Yeah.
What is that called?
Is.
The 3D thing.
Yeah. The holographic.
Yeah, holographic thing. Yeah. It has all those in it. And it was just complete bullshit, but it's kind of fantastic.
Lenticular, right? That's what it is.
Is that what
right?
it is?
Lenticular.
Yeah. Good job, Rebecca.
Thank you. Okay, I'm gone. Thanks.
Your lenticular Virgin Mary postcards. Thank you.
No, but yeah, that thing was frightening because that book, I mean, it was gorgeous. You know, they sunk a lot of money in
it. It had to be $100 a copy, at least.
Yeah.
And there were thousands of them.
Yeah.
And they were sent to England and...
Well, give us the gist on the book. What was in there?
Well, the basic idea behind the book was it was mainly a series of photographs showing that a 2-million-year-old shrimp looked pretty much like a modern shrimp.
Right. It's like it hasn't evolved.
You know, there's an unevolved shrimp and an evolved shrimp, and they look exactly the same, which is different from the sort of classic intelligent design.
Mm-hmm. It was literally like 100 pages of things that still look the same.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm convinced.
Yeah.
God did it.
Fossil worm, then modern worm.
The copy blocks underneath each picture were just pure gold. I can't even do them justice.
It was incredible.
But I don't even need to say this, but don't they get the idea that once it falls into the niche and it works, that it's going to stay that way, you know?
There's no punctuated equilibrium.
Yeah, right. I mean, look at the shark.
No pressure to evolve. And
They don't want to talk about punctuated equilibrium because it shoots down that argument. Remember Dwayne Gish's, his entire comment about it was, you can argue about, you know, punctuated equilibrium all day, but look at this, not changing over time. That was it. Just a complete sidestep because you're right. It just completely torpedoes this line of argument. And basically, in a nutshell, it's Stephen Jay Gould and Niles Edwards' idea that most of the time, most species are not evolving. They're pretty much just going along at equilibrium with their environment. And it's this equilibrium, which could be millions of years long, is just punctuated by occasional, you know, speciation and rapid evolution.
Oh, because of the environment might change or something along those lines.
Right.
I've never seen this, but I know it's true that Niles Eldridge has a collection of cornets, that musical instrument.
Mm-hmm. Can't wait to see where this is going.
And he has, like, I don't know, like 150 or something of them. And he has them on his wall at his house, and you can see the evolution of cornet with punctuated equilibrium, so that, for example, the cornet was used before the First World War by adult Scottish men celebrating whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then the First World War happened, and it became more to do with marching bands for masons or something. And so they needed a different shape for the hand, or they had to make more. After the Second World War, it became more of a kid's instrument for cheerleading stuff. And so you could see, either side of the war, the cornet, there's those This was the punctuate, so you can see it through the corner on his wall developing. That's fantastic.
Awesome.
Wow.
Punctuated equilibrium, technological evolution. Yeah. That is awesome. Do you have any other projects you're working on? Anything you want us to plug? Any books that are coming out?
Well, I'm not working on any books of my own. I'm sort of kind of like noodling around, but I am thinking of doing I'm hoping to do a screenplay based on a book by a writer called Lawrence Wright, which is called Remembering Satan, mm-hmm. which is about a case, which is very much due to skepticism. It's about a case in the 80s where a cop in Washington State had a daughter who started remembering being abused as a child. And it was a fairly sort of reasonable accusation. And the cop was then told about this, and he said, God, I don't remember that at all. But then his preacher came in and said, well, you know, God will help you to remember this stuff. And then a therapist who was doing that repressed memory, regression, hypnotism stuff, started to get in there as well. And he began to have a vague recollection of maybe he did abuse her. And then she started to remember that, in fact, there was a satanic kind of quality.
There we go.
And so then he started to remember the satanic stuff. And then she remembered that they were sacrificing babies.
Oh. Yeah. And then Satan remembered that, oh, yeah, I remember those two guys with the babies.
But then at a certain point, like he was a cop, so all the other cops were like, wow. And they were all sort of totally into this child abuse repressed memory thing. So they were getting very interested in this and saying, wow, he's remembering this. This is terrible what's happening. And then she started to remember that there were poker nights where there were other cops there and they were involved too.
God. And they weren't so happy.
Hold on a second. But it's really about this guy who was a functioning cop and a human being, and he began to sort of remember things that hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is a lot of life is about what we agree is reality. Mm-hmm. And he had made an agreement with himself and with these therapists and the priest that in fact fantasy was memory, and that the two were the same thing. And he's still in prison, I believe. 20 years later.
Wow.
Amazing.
That's one of the things I'm interested in.
Wow. Is there some place that people, do you have a website or something where people can go to keep track of you?
MatthewChapman.us.
.us.
Oh, I like that.
Patriotic, baby.
Sounds good.
Of course, I have to plug sciencedebate2008.com. Yes. And we need some money. So if anyone feels like going there and contributing, we'd much appreciate it. And support and people signing on. Because the bigger the support, the more likely it is this will happen.
There's not that many people alive that are related to, you know, first of all, he's a huge figure. But is it strange to have someone in your past like that?
It is. Well, I mean, sometimes I think of it as strange. I don't really believe in inheritance, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't believe in the aristocracy and the royal family. And I think an accident of birth is not something to be proud of. It's kind of something that you can use to make a good point.
Yeah.
But I mean, in no way do I feel special. I don't have any kind of scientific background.
Yeah.
But I did fall into talking about this stuff because of the connection. And I'm not ashamed of it, but there's nothing to be proud of because I just happen to have.
Yeah,
popped it's out interesting. In that area.
But I always thought it would be surreal in a way. You're like, wow, I'm related to that monumental figure, you know?
I think there is a thing, I mean, I wrote about this in my first book, Trials of the Monkey, that I think there is an expectation that most people have as they grow up, particularly in America, that you will do better than your father and his father and so on. Mm-hmm. In my situation, that's unlikely to happen. And of course, I mean, I'm so far away now from Darwin that I don't think it's a problem for me. But I do think there was a certain amount of that feeling in the generation above mine where most of them did try and enter the academic world. And
did anything good happen to you because of that?
I got laid a lot.
Yeah. I was two questions away from going there.
And with smart girls. You know, the it doesn't work with the students.
And brainy chicks are the best.
But the brainy chicks are the best. What are you doing
this? This is a good time to end. Hey, no. Give me a couple more questions.
Give me a couple more questions.
All right, go ahead.
Because I have a few funny things I want to throw out, too. Did you ever grow the beard just to see if there's a similarity?
No. But I'm doing the baldness. It's coming. I'm waiting for that.
All right, I'm done.
Well, he had more questions if he had said yes.
Well, Matthew, this has been an unexpected pleasure. You know, this, you're the kind of person that, that we come to TAM to meet, somebody that wasn't really on our radar, but it, this has been wonderful.
Yeah, it's
thank
been
you
great.
So much.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Thanks for sitting with us.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a quick follow-up to the interview regarding Science Debate 2008. Both the Obama and the McCain campaigns have submitted their answers in writing to the 14 science questions submitted to them by Science Debate 2008. So you can go to that website, and we'll have the link to look at their answers.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my expert panel of skeptics to sniff out the fake. And you all could play at home, or in your car, wherever you listen to our podcast.
Don't play in the shower. That's weird.
Yeah.
Makes me uncomfortable to think about.
I don't know. If you got one of those shower MP3 players, that's fine, ooh, I guess. Well, here we go. Item number one. Scientists discover the world's oldest fossilized organisms, which date to about 4 billion years old. Item number two, a new study shows that the HIV epidemic actually began around 1900, much earlier than previously thought. And item number three, scientists demonstrate that the limit of how far away you can read text is determined by the spacing between letters, not the size of the letters. Evan, please go first.
Boy, this first one is wild. The world's oldest fossilized organism is 4 billion years old. Yeah, I'm doing some quick math in my head, and that's not adding up too well. You know, because the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, if I recall. And wasn't it just like this moltenous, massive, just, you know, how could anything exist in that? In that really primordial Earth.
Soup.
I don't think it was even soup at that time. I think it. But I'm having I'm having a real hard time accepting that one. The second one about the HIV epidemic beginning around 1900, much earlier than previously thought. Sure, I don't see anything wrong with that. It's fascinating, but certainly reasonable. And then the last one is about reading text and the limits determined by spacing between the letters and not the size of the letters. And that, to me, makes a lot of sense. And I'm almost afraid that, you know, it seems like that first one, the 4-billion-year-old organism, is really stands out like a sore thumb, almost so much so that it could be the curveball. So I'll guess that it's the curveball, and I'm going to say that the text determining the spacing determined by the spacing between the letters, not the size of the letters. I'll say that one is fiction.
Okay, Bob?
You truly are a bastard. I've read scores of science articles. Not one of them is on here. All of these are crazy implausible. Not one of them. Oh, my God. I just got, like, the lesser of three evils.
Steve subscribes to the Journal of Obscure Research.
It's the least of three evils. Lesser's two.
Yes, lesser's two. Least, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right. I know that. I mean, none of these are... I mean, what the hell? First off, let's start with three. The limit of how far you can read text is determined by the spacing and not the size of the letters. Well, that's... Maybe it's just the way you worded this, Steve, but come on. I could see how the spacing could have an impact, but the size has no impact on how far away you could read text. Well, how could... That's patently absurd. I can't believe you're saying that. Can you elaborate?
Not really.
He could, but he'd be giving it away.
I'll let that one stand on its own.
The 1900 HIV epidemic, I mean, I've read, and actually recently, relatively recently, that they pretty much pinned this down to one guy messing with monkeys in the 1950s. So now it was it's 57 years before that. That doesn't sound right either. And then forget the whole 4-billion-year-old fossils. What the hell? I forget the exact timeline when, you know, the Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. I forget exactly when it cooled, but I thought it was, you know, after that, 3.5 billion maybe. I mean, how long does it take to cool the surface at least? Because it was pretty damn molten for a long time. Oh, wait, let me get my three-sided coin here.
It's tails or wings.
All right, let's see.
Surely you have a three-sided die somewhere. None of your nerd games.
I use a six-sided, and then you know, one and two is two. One, two and three is two.
Or you could use a 12-sided and go with sets of threes. Or
I actually do that to randomly determine which one's going to be the fiction each week.
Of course you do.
Yeah, it's smart.
Everyone does.
Otherwise, there'll be a subconscious pattern. It won't be truly random.
Yeah, you need a random number generator.
Crap, I really want to do the 4 billion one, but...
Me too, but I didn't.
That's just so obvious. But the dates are kind of fuzzy in my head. I'm going to go with the 1900 HIV discovery. I think I thought it was pretty damn clear that in the 50s.
Okay, Rebecca?
All right. That's the only one I'm fairly certain is correct. So, like Evan, I was torn between...
Two lovers?
The oldest fossilized organism and the space between the letters. The space between the letters thing just jumps out at me as being particularly goofball because I'm thinking of the eye tests, the eye exams you take, and there's plenty of space between the letters, but I'm effed if it gets too small. So I don't know. I think that that's the fiction. So I'm going to side with Evan on that one.
That's right, okay. Because it's not just spacing between the letters, it's the reading between the lines. Thank you.
So you all agree, you all agree, despite yourselves, that scientists discover the world's oldest fossilized organisms, which date to around 4 billion years old. You all agree that that's science, and that one is, in fact,
crazy,
fiction.
Science.
Ah.
Oh, nailed
us. Bastard.
Damn you,
nailed
Steve.
Us hard. Ugh. It was so obvious, too.
Nailed us hard. Can we avoid the phrases one. Like that?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's one of those ones where, you know, the date that I choose had to be enough to seem off, but not obviously outrageous. So, yeah, you know, the timeline is not totally outrageous. This definitely would be pushing back the oldest fossil if that were true. The oldest fossils, by the way, are, guys, you guys know this?
Is it like three?
Yes, stromatolites. Stromatolites.
Mm. And the oldest stromatolites date to about 3.5 billion, so about 3.5 right. billion years. Yeah. So this would have pushed it back by about 0.5 billion years, but it's not true. So, yeah, so still 3.5 billion years ago, stromatolites, which are basically like carpets of single-celled animals that just piled up and then fossilized. Mm. And they existed for billions of years. I mean, there are stromatolites that are like 0.5 billion years old.
I believe there's a lot in Australia, right?
Yep, that's right. The oldest ones are, in fact, I believe, in Australia.
Crikey!
And also South Africa, so...
2 and 3 are true?
Hang on. But what is true is that scientists have discovered the oldest known rock on the Earth.
Oh.
That is over 4 billion years old, 4.28 billion
wow.
years.
Wow.
So the probably among the first, you know, rock to solidify. And, you know, continents have been actually fairly persistent over the last 4.2 billion years, luckily. And this is a scientist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington and McGill University believe what they have found to be 4.28 billion year old samples of rock from Canada, published in this week's journal Science. And this is, so far, this is the oldest rock that we have identified. So, you know, at least parts of the Earth were solidifying about that point in time.
I'd love to hold that rock.
Yeah.
What if they break it open and find fossilized organism?
that would be cool.
Then we win.
The chemical composition of these rocks resembles that of volcanic rock. So, you know, that tells us that this is coming from a point in time where there was still a lot of tectonic plate activity and a lot of, you know, lava bursting forth. Rock this old is extremely rare because, you know, it tends to get recycled over time and not many places on the Earth where it hasn't been recycled. Of course, the sea floor, the oldest sea floor is about 125 million years old because the ocean floor is constantly being turned over. It's like a conveyor belt, you know, with it emerging at the divergent regions and then diving back down at the subduction zones. So that one is the fiction. You guys, again, you had the right thinking, but it's hard to be so sure in your mind unless you really remember it or looked at it recently what the timeline was to know that that was just a little bit too far in the past for any fossilized life. Probably before life formed.
Yeah.
Which means that number two, a new study shows that the HIV epidemic actually began around 1900, much earlier than previously thought, is science. Very interesting.
Wow. How'd they show that?
And Bob, you're right. Previously, there was thinking, you know, 1950s is probably when the HIV dates to. But this is a recent study where they actually had samples from a 40-year-old HIV gene fragment in wax-embedded lymph node tissue, Bob, from a woman from Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Mm. So it comes from 1959. They also have samples from the 1960s. So what they were able to do by comparing these oldest samples is to see, well, what are the differences among them? And they were able to basically create timelines of how these strains of HIV changed over time. And if you extrapolate back, it looks as if it emerged around 1900.
Wow.
Which coincides with a period of urbanization in these regions of Africa. So they think that the virus really started to spread in the human population when, you know, people in Africa were really first concentrating in cities, in urban settings. And scientists demonstrate that the limit of how far away you can read text is determined by the spacing between letters, not the size of letters, is also science. Now, I was careful in my wording of that, and it does seem a little counterintuitive, you know, which is obviously why I chose it. It's the limit of how far away you could see. So in other words, you lose the ability to read text first, you know, because of the spacing, before you would lose it purely on the size of the letters.
But the spacing between them is what messes you up first.
Yes, exactly. So that's the limiting factor. The limiting factor is the spacing between the letters, not the size of the letters themselves. Hmm. You know, when our brains are processing visual information, it uses certain processing to separate things out so that we could pick out an object from other objects. That's obviously an important thing for our visual system to be able to do. And if you have too many things together, that's a phenomenon known as crowding. And the crowding occurs when the brain is no longer able to know where one thing ends and another thing begins. And that's really critical for reading letters. When you can't separate one letter from another, your brain doesn't know what it is, doesn't know what the letter is. So then you lose the ability to read. And that happens long before just pure letter size would make it not able to read.
Okay.
Well, good job, Steve, anyway.
Thank you. It's been a long time since I've gotten one of you guys.
Yeah.
That was one of the best ones.
Well, we thought we'd give you one.
Time.
You know.
Thanks. I appreciate you throwing me
a cold shower in the morning.
So I'm going to do this week's quote because, again, we're missing Jay because he's...
We are Jayless.
Yeah, he's...
Surfing
brewing
in Siberia.
Belgian beer and with those monks. So this week's quote comes from a man we all know and love named Charles Darwin. He said, "The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference." Charles Darwin!
That's shameless materialist. Yeah. Darwin.
Do you know Darwin was a Darwinist?
Darwin was a Darwinist. That's true.
I met a descendant of Charles Darwin not too long ago.
That's true. That's true.
And I should mention that quote came from Steve Yerby.
Thanks, Steve.
Richmond, Vermont. Thank you, Steve.
Well done, Steve.
So we've got an event thing coming up.
We do.
People are going to that, right?
In a week.
October 11th in Fairfield, Connecticut, we are recording a live show. The information is on our website and on our message board.
So and Facebook.
And Facebook, so please join us. It's going to be a lot of fun. And the night before, the New York City Skeptics are hosting James Randi. So if you're in the area, check that out. You can make the trip and go to both events.
Doubleheader.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Absolutely. Well, thank you all for joining me once again.
Oh, thank you, Steve.
Surely.
Yeah, it was fun.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.